This is CliffCentral.com.
Hello there, it's Michael Cowan here on the Futurology Show, and in studio I've got Big Boy Brett. How are you, Brett?
Boom. How's it, bud? How are you doing, man?
Very well, very well. But I'm excited today because today we've got a special guest.
How excited are you, Mike?
I really am, actually. Because you do
look excited. I'm loving your shirt, by the way.
You are. Becoming classics.
Becoming classics. It actually says for our guests, I'm not getting older, I'm just becoming a wet old fart.
No, thank you. Becoming a classic. But anyway, sorry about this, but... Professor Steve Keen is our guest today. Are you there, Professor? Can you hear us loud and clear?
Yes, I can. I hope you can hear me well. I'll change over to the microphone here to hopefully improve the sound.
No, fantastic. You're coming through loud and clear. Now, I've got Brett Sinclair in the studio with me, who's an ex-Googler, and he's the clown of the show. But
hello, Professor. How are you doing?
Very well.
We're really excited to speak with you today. I have to admit, Mike has been going on about this session for, I'd like to say days, if not weeks, possibly months.
Yeah. I'm excited because, you know, maybe just a bit of background. You've just written the book. The next financial crisis, is it coming? You predicted the 2008 crisis. One of the few one of the few economists who actually got it right. Mm. Professor, before we dive in, do you want to just give us a background to who you are and where you're currently working from, and because you're an academic.
Yeah, well, I'm for the next year. I'm currently at the University of Kingston in London. Yeah. I've been here for 3 years. Before that, I was in Australia at the University of Western Sydney. And I've been trying to establish a heterodox education and non-mainstream economics because I find the universities, particularly the top universities, Cambridge's and Oxford's of the world, are promoting the existing paradigm when it's manifestly false. So I'm trying to develop alternatives. And in that basis, I'm going to be going out and ceasing being in the university sector as of July or August of next year and going out and being crowdfunded on Patreon instead, simply because universities have been made an impossible place to do non-mainstream work of any description, whichever discipline you talk about. Everything is designed to reward the existing paradigm because bureaucrats are trying to control research and they haven't got a clue.
Absolutely. We call it academic ignorance on our side here. And I quite agree because I've actually got an economics major and I hate to say it, but I know nothing about economics because it's exactly this. You know, we operated in a world of perfect competition.
Mike, can I add that to a list of things, Mike?
You can, Brett. You really can. But Professor, you wrote the book predicting the next financial crash. Sorry, I actually completely fluffed that up.
Can we avoid another financial crisis?
Sorry about that. You wrote the book. How well has that been received?
It's gone down very well in the UK because I'm extremely well known over here. Yeah. So it tends to bounce around between 2,000th and 5,000th in Amazon's bestseller list, occasionally topping economics and macro. But in terms of getting into exposure in the American market, I haven't had the chance to promote it as much as I was able to do with debunking economics, so it hasn't had as much of an impact as I would like over there. But those who read it, I mean, it was an excellent project to be given by the publishers because they had a target of a series of questions on capitalism, hence the overall fact that it has a question mark in the title, and a limit of no more than 25,000 words. And it's extremely strong discipline to write to that short length and still cover a topic well. So I quite enjoyed the challenge.
Well, I must congratulate you because I found it an exceptionally well-written book, and I've actually read through it 3 times because the argument you lay out is a very logical argument, and when you look at the data, it's kind of obvious. And you've written the book in a very simple, easy to read, easy to understand way, and for non-economic discipline, it's a very easy book to read. So I must congratulate you. It's the best book I've read on economics.
I mean, just before we go too far with it, I'd like if you can give us a summary for our guests, right? Because I'd really like our guests to kind of get a clear understanding of what you're trying to address in the book.
Yeah.
The basic summary is quite simple, and that is that banks create money by lending. So rather than the bank being a warehouse that takes in some money from somebody else and lends it out to you, and therefore the money, it's lent of your money to somebody else, I mean, they can spend more, but you can spend less, and therefore there's no real impact from the banking sector on the real economy. That's mainstream thinking. Mm. In reality, banks are not warehouses. They're factories. They make money. When they create it, they create money at the same time. You then spend that borrowed money. So the change in private debt is a major factor in demand.
Yeah.
And the larger level of debt gets to be compared to GDP, the more swings and roundabouts in the creation of credit cause booms and slumps in the economy. Mm. And that's what caused the financial crisis back in 2008. And we're now living in the aftermath of that with, as it happens, the highest level of private sector debt in the history of capitalism.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. And the origination of this thinking comes from Herman Minsky. Do you want to just give us a background to who Herman Minsky was and the impact that he's had? Because he hasn't had the impact he should have had.
No. I mean, Hyman was well and truly an outsider. And I mean, his parents were refugees from Russia. After the Bolshevik Revolution. But they were Menshevik rebels. They weren't right-wingers trying to get away. They were left-wingers who opposed what the Bolsheviks were attempting to do, to go directly from feudalism to capitalism. It's a socialism, pardon me, by jumping over capitalism in the meantime. And the Mensheviks, which were actually Hyman Minsky's parents, who met in Chicago, separate refugees from Menshevik Russia, they believed that you had to go through a capitalist phase first of all. Now, that made me think about Minsky being raised, the family environment in which he's raised, Marx and a critique of capitalism is part of it, but it's anti the Soviet Union. It's anti the belief you can jump over the capitalist phase completely, which, of course, history proved the Mensheviks to be correct on that particular argument. So he starts off non-orthodox, does a degree in mathematics after fighting in the Second World War. So he's got his hands dirty. He's not like Donald Trump, who had cook ankle and couldn't go fight in Vietnam. You know, he actually went and fought in the Second World War. I think he got his degree in mathematics after he came back from that, which is part of the whole Eisenhower slash Roosevelt attempt to reintegrate war veterans after the war. And then he did his PhD under Joseph Schumpeter, and Schumpeter was the classic person who believed that capitalism is inherently unstable, but that instability is creative instability. So this is the very various background of Minsky. And because he'd also been raised I think he was born in 1919 or thereabouts. His parents were refugees after 1917 from Russia. So they were born sort of 1919, 1920, that period. So he was a teenager during the Great Depression. And the question that interests him when he became an academic economist is, can it happen again?
Yeah.
And that's literally a quote. And he said, if it can happen, why hasn't it happened between 1945 and when he was writing, which at that stage was the 1970s and 80s? And he said that there must be something about the institutions and the arrangements that occurred in the post-war period that made it very different to the crisis, because we had gone, when he was writing this particular paper, Can It Happen Again? It was 1982. And he said, we've gone 30 years without a serious financial crisis. And that is unheard of in the history of capitalism.
Yeah.
But of course, now, of course, he gave an explanation as how we get into a situation of crisis. And of course, we are now in that situation of crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. And his famous quote comes from, was, stability creates the instability. Do you want to take us through the understanding of that and how we've wound up at this point in terms of being at a crisis, and what are the underlying factors of that crisis? Because there are a couple of very clear things from a macroeconomics perspective, and you go into a lot of detail around macroeconomics and the fact that we cannot mirror microeconomics. I mean, it's as simple as saying we can understand the body of the ocean from a single drop of water. We can't. It doesn't work.
A drop of water you can, a single H2O molecule you can't. And this is economics is caught up with a whole range of myths. And and one of the foundation myths is that microeconomics determines macro. And if you can explain what an individual consumer does, an individual firm, both in visualized as isolated from the market, and you can then extrapolate that to the market level, mathematically you can't. And this is actually bad mathematics to believe that you can. So, like if that's why I say in the book, if you know the property of a single molecule of H2O, you cannot understand what two molecules will do together, which is form water under some circumstances, ice under others, snow under other circumstances. That depends on the interaction between those identical molecules. Well, even more so for human society, what actually gives its character and its both its potential and its for both good and bad, the interactions between the entities, and microeconomics leaves that out completely.
Totally.
I've a very interesting point because of the complexity that lies around those different circumstances. As we enter this world of machine learning and artificial intelligence, surely that makes it easier for society to be able to crunch down those opportunities and build the mathematics in. Am I making a vast assumption?
You're making a vast assumption.
I think if we have algorithms fighting algorithms, we're going to get more instability out of that. Yeah. But like the basic point for Minsky's logic was to say that that there was a relationship between private debt and economic activity. Yeah. Now, that puts him right outside the mainstream straight away, because a major thing they've done in mainstream thinking is hermetically seal finance from economics. So macroeconomic models by central banks around the world and treasuries and mainstream economists had no role for banks or debt or money in them. And Minsky is saying, well, that's where you've got to start, with a role for debt. And what he said was, if you situate yourself in historical time, then there's been some form of debt-induced crisis in the recent past, which means everybody is conservative about the amount of debt they'll take on. But because the economy has recovered, most of the projects that are debt-financed succeed. And people then think, oh, if we were more levered, we would have made more money. So a period of stable economic growth leads to rising expectations, and that's where the idea of stability being destabilizing comes from.
Absolutely. And if we look at the underlying idea of innovation, because Minsky looked at his model and said, let's look at the strength of the capitalist economy, and that's really the idea of growth and innovation that drives that. But that in itself has become its greatest weakness.
This is one of the things that I found appealing about Minsky, because when I became a critic of mainstream economics, I was at the end of my first year at university back in 1971, and I started reading outside the textbooks and reading the literature. And of course, you read a lot of Marxist stuff and a lot of Austrian stuff and so on. And what I found was that none of the either pay-ins to capitalism from the Austrians or predictions of doom from the Marxists made any sense to me. They didn't seem to be describing the system I was observing until I read Minsky. And the point about Minsky was that he said that the fundamental instability in capitalism is upwards. The tendency to turn doing well into a speculative boom is the fundamental instability and weakness of capitalism, but it's also a strength. And this is the intriguing thing. Rather than saying capitalism has this weakness that Marxists would focus upon and so on, or this strength which Austrians focus upon and see no potential for conflict, he was saying here's a strength which can lead to breakdown.
Absolutely. And from that strength, because I was reading through one of the chapters in your book, and I sat down and drew it out on a piece of paper, because it's really a boom and a bust. We get excited about the growth as entrepreneurs, as capitalists. From that, we invest more money into our respective projects.
Because it's exponential, essentially, right?
Not yet. Mm. Not yet. But we get the idea of growth and the opportunity for us to make a profit. We go and borrow more money, which increases the leverage within the economy, but it also drives up the wages, because you make a critical point around the distribution of income and the role that inequality has in society, and it's an outcome of this growth, because it's always the workers that come off short, even if they're not the ones that are leveraging the debt.
I can see where you're going.
Yeah,
Mike.
Yeah.
You
can see it. This is the intriguing. Marx even got this right back when he first built a verbal version of the model that became the basis of the mathematical modeling that I did on where cycles come from. And Marx argued, and this is a quote from Capital, to put it mathematically, the level of investment is the independent, not the dependent variable. The level of wages is dependent, not the independent variable. In other words, investment determines what wages are going to be.
Yes.
And I added to the existence of debt to that. So what you have is when a boom goes on, the boom will start because the rate of profit is such that capitalists are willing to invest all they're earning in profits. Therefore, they borrow money to finance that extra investment. And by doing that, they both drive up economic activity and they drive up the amount of money they're paying to bankers.
Yeah.
But they also eventually enable workers, because of employment falling, workers have a higher capacity to demand wage rises, as that starts to happen, the amount of money that capitalists are making at the peak of the boom is less than they expect because they're paying more out to workers and also, of course, more out to bankers. And then the slump begins at that particular point. So that distribution of income factor is vital. And what it means is the boom will restart again when capitalists get back to the same rate of profit that led them to be willing to invest more than they earn, and they start borrowing from banks once more. But in that particular situation, you know, when the next boom along, there's more going to bankers and therefore less going to workers.
Yeah.
So the real beneficiaries of this level of the rising level of debt are not the capitalists, it's the bankers again and the workers who lose.
It's always the bankers.
I'm so glad I'm out of banking. I feel like I have this dirty cloth on me.
You do.
I don't want to be associated. You,
the studio is smelling quite bad, actually. It's starting to become a bit more rosier. But the bank always wins, which is the problem. And it's the originate. You coined the term the origination of debt, which I absolutely love.
Banker, because we talk about banks as warehouses, which is wrong. And what I said instead, rather than having the term of my non-orthodox people who understand banking, we used to call it endogenous money. That means nothing to anybody unless you're inside the industry. So what I say is it's bank-originated money and debt, otherwise known as bombed.
Yeah.
And of course, our economies have been bombed well and truly.
Steve, can we just talk about the current scenario? Because the crisis is coming, and the short answer to your book is, yes, it's coming, and we cannot avoid it. Can we just talk quickly about the zombie countries that are coming through based on the three criteria of unemployment, the percentage of debt to GDP over a period of 5 years, as well as the private debt to GDP? Because you've got a very, very interesting outline.
Are we talking
outline.
South Africa here?
We're not talking about South Africa. I'm actually looking at your data right now, because I have a website, profstevekeen.com, and under that, one of the headings is crisis ? Which is, of course, supporting the book, and you'll find data there. And then if you go down, you'll find you can click on a table that takes you to the data for particular countries. And on that basis, South Africa is one of the few countries which is neither a walking dead of debt, where they've had a crisis back in 2008 and have far too much overhang of debt and not very much credit growth. Those are what I call the walking dead of debt. The zombies to be are ones who managed to borrow their way through the crisis and now have a much higher level of debt and are going to have a crunch. South Africa is one of the few countries in neither of the above. You're one of the humans on that sense, because your level of private debt peaked just after the financial crisis at about 80% of GDP, fell a bit, and it's now about 70-75% of GDP. That's half my trigger level.
Yes.
So you're not going to be zombified, but you might find your exports decline because some of your major export destinations are going to be zombified.
And in fact, if I did the numbers, I think it's about 60% of or 63% of global GDP will be zombified.
It's more. It's about one third. That's the leftovers.
This
country, like China is about. One half the size of the American economy. The American economy is about one third of the global economy. So you're talking 1/6 to one third, not 2/3.
Okay, but it will have a big impact on us because we are dependent. Just in terms of South Africa, and one of the questions, because I think we're an interesting country in that we have a first world and we have a third world.
High interest rates, right?
Yeah, let's not even get to the interest rates yet. We'll come back. If we look at our Gini coefficient, I mean, we're sitting at extreme poverty with massive unemployment. I think our official stats are about 27.4%. Yet I think if we look at our youth, we're sitting at about a 60% youth unemployment. Which
Ouch.
It's a crisis. I mean, Steve, I think we're probably in a worse state, because I think if we look at the economic, the unemployment numbers, that's where our problem sits, not in the debt numbers. But I do also think, and I've got no data to back this up, if I look at what is technically our first world, I can't imagine our level of debt is as comfortable as the 80%, 75%. Certainly in terms of the first world economy in South Africa, we're probably not far off your benchmarks, because, I mean, certainly when I speak to my friends and I speak to my wife, she tells me how expensive it is becoming. You know, our ability to stretch our money is becoming less and less and less. So I think we're sitting in a very interesting scenario, but we don't have any data to really qualify and dig into it.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm looking at the data right now, which the Bank of International Settlements publishes, and they show a corporate debt level in 2008 of about 45% of GDP and a household debt of about 35%.
Okay.
There you go. Fast forward, corporate debt's down to about 35%, household debt up to about 38%. So you've had a slight decline in your level of private debt. I think more what's happening, you have massive inequality in your country for obvious historical reasons. And with that massive inequality, you don't have the mass market. That existed in less unequal societies like even America. And consequently, you don't have much investment and you're basically dependent upon external demand. And if that's not sufficient, then not much investment happens and you remain basically stagnated.
Totally. Absolutely. Because it's a crisis and it has been a crisis for literally forever. It's a massive issue and we don't actually know how to solve it. But can we just talk around this idea of inequality? Because there's so many great projects and initiatives, but reading through the economic model, it almost seems we're not going to solve the inequality problem until we solve the economic model. Am I correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's fundamental because I've got a range of work that's not actually covered in that book about where inequality comes from and where wealth comes from. And fundamentally, what we've had with economic theory, both left-wing and right-wing theory, have ignored the role of energy in seeing how we actually produce output. And in reality, what actually GDP is useful work, and useful work is turning available energy into products. Engineers have dramatically improved our capability to do that over time. But it's not the labor and the capital in that sense that are producing the output, which is mainstream economic thinking. It's the energy. Labor and capital are both earning far more than their so-called marginal product. What we're doing is fighting over the distribution of the extra energy we generate. And we have a financial sector of wealth that's part of the whole distribution of all that. If you have a massively unequal society, as you guys do have, and Latin America is fairly similar on that front, then there's no mass market. And therefore, the bargaining power of workers to get wage rises is stultified, but it also means your level of investment and demand is stultified. The rich do very well, thanks very much.
Yeah.
But there's no impetus to develop and invest and innovate.
Do you have any idea how we solve these problems? Do you have any thinking around some models that we can apply? Because certainly when I look at our government, and I'll come back to the central bank and the role of the central bank, but our Minister of Finance, who is completely and utterly clueless, who's a political appointment, who actually has absolutely no idea what he's doing. I think it's his fifth ministerial position, and every other one he's had has been nothing but a disaster. And we're sitting in a state capture. I don't know if you've been watching or heard of Bell Pottinger's demise that came out of South Africa. But we're sitting in a very, very interesting and terminal political situation. But the they want to try and reduce our deficit as opposed to increasing it. Do you have any idea or models that we can actually be looking at to try and solve these problems?
Are you running a trade deficit?
Yes, we are. But
how large?
I don't think it's – I think it's about 3.5%, and they want to reduce it to about 3%. And I'm not sure on those numbers. Sorry, Steve. I didn't check those numbers.
See, that's a realistic thing to worry about because you'll usually get governments obsessing about the government deficit. And, in fact, governments can create money even more easily than banks can, so they don't actually face any – financial constraint, but your constraint really is that balance of trade deficit. If you have that sort of order of 3%, you can't really afford to stimulate the economy too much through government spending without that then leaking into exports and into import demand. That is a real limitation. I think in some ways you've got to think in a mercantilist way. The only successful countries that have been able to insulate themselves very well are countries like Japan and Germany, which are running trade surpluses at the order of 5% of GDP. And they did that by breaking all the rules of the WTO, by not opening up to competition, by having domestic promoting domestic industry and so on. And you have the capability to do that as well because you do have an unusual combination of a high level of technological capability in the country and massive physical resources as well. So you have the capability to exploit trade controls to your own advantage.
Yeah, we just need someone with a bit of corp to do it. Stephen,
you have neither, by the sounds of it.
No, we really don't. It's a very interesting situation. I'll be interested to see how we resolve this. But Stephen, in terms of you know, we talk about the exponential business, and you know, we look at businesses like Uber that use technology to really scale. From what you're saying, that's an advantage to us. If we could find ways to scale our local industry to stimulate local demand around local products and services, we would be in a very, very good and healthy position in terms of the rest of the world.
Yeah, and like one thing you can do if you decide you're going to be unemployment at 26% is enough to say, you know, that's our major problem. We don't care if we annoy people about what we do with trade rules. Then you boost government spending to try to reduce unemployment, but you also put up tariffs. You put up controls on it, and you direct that money domestically rather than for internationally. If anybody complains, you say, well, we're stimulating our economy. What are you doing?
100%.
If you're not stimulating, we've got the right to hang on to that stimulus for our own benefit rather than for yours. So you take on the trade authorities over there on that front. Not exactly easy, but no. You guys have been international pariahs in the past. I'm sure you can capable of doing it again for a good reason rather than a bad one.
Yeah, I know. I think it's a bit more complicated because our greatest export at the moment is by a family. I don't know if you've even read any of the news about our state capture. We've got an Indian immigrant family who have effectively captured our president, and I think they've moved about 50 billion or probably 100 billion rand off into Dubai. So we're sitting in a very, very interesting scenario. But just coming back to the exponential growth, in the case of the States or even the UK or Australia, the exponential model and this increasing drive, because what it actually brings is this exponential pace of change. What would the impact be in a more stabilized, well, not a stabilized or a zombie economy? Would it be a positive thing in driving exponential businesses to try and stimulate that demand?
Funny question, a bit confusing, I'm afraid to say, okay. But I'll try to interpret it. You're talking about the growth and ecological limits, or are you talking about the stimulus from the?
No, I'm thinking more the use of technology. So if we look at Uber, okay. you know they've gone from
about
a one
velocity, right?
Yeah, it's really about the velocity in terms of driving their growth in terms of 1, 2, 4, 8. So, there's a very strong drive, certainly in the VC world, you know, the entrepreneurial world, to try and drive these entrepreneurial businesses. And, you know, you're going to get 1 out of 100 that actually succeed, some that may do okay. But what it's doing is it's driving the pace of change at an exponential rate as well, because it's forcing us to move the cycles shorter and shorter. So effectively, you know, just in terms of cycles, your boom and bust become closer and closer. And I'm making an assumption on that as well.
Yeah, the booms and busts, whether they come close or not, depends on the financial dynamics rather than the innovative side of things. But what you've targeted is something that I want to, because obviously finance plays a role in enabling technological development to occur. Because if you get money as an entrepreneur, you can actually buy stuff and turn your idea into something concrete, which is what you want to do. But of course, existing banks have very little incentive to lend to entrepreneurs because there's no guarantee of getting their money back. And of course, you know, if 4 out of 5 fail, then the one that succeeds, they only an interest income on what they've lent, and they're well and truly behind the eight ball. So what I'd like to see is the development of what I call entrepreneurial equity loans and equity banks, where the banks behave a bit like a combination of a venture capitalist and a normal bank. And rather than giving you a loan, they give you money in return for an equity stake in your business. And then in that basis, they might have, you know, 4 out of 5 might still fail, but the one that succeeds can do very well. It's not a magic bullet. I have a lot of venture capitalists telling me that most venture capitalists lose money. But if you see banking as a way of creating money out of double entry bookkeeping,
Absolutely. Then
I'd rather have that money being created for the sake of entrepreneurs, whether or not they succeed, because that will stimulate the economy and we'll get the good ideas as well.
Exactly.
So, I mean, the only bank that I've come across that does something like that is the Silicon Valley Bank. Are there any other examples of that? I mean, they do a phenomenal job at taking a small equity as well as backing VCs, and they use the same kind of algorithms to de-risk their lending profiles. Are we seeing other kind of institutions getting into this game? I mean, it could spell a great
There's one called, I know one company with, started by a couple of friends of mine, who we've become friends through economic issues, of course, called Equitile over in London. That's right. A guy who used to run a private bank became horrified by the level of debt. He wrote an excellent book called Debtonator. So rather than Detonator, D-E-B-T, Detonator. I think of Andy's last name right now, but that's another book I recommend reading. He's saying we need to get more of an equity-based and less of a debt-based culture. And so that's starting to happen. But in general, because we come from the debt-based culture of the past, we've got a system which rewards property speculation and doesn't reward innovation.
Absolutely. True. Absolutely. Your other suggestion was really the helicopter money. We look at quantitative easing. All it did was made the bankers richer, but it didn't trickle down. I mean, that's another fallacy that comes through from mainstream, that the trickle down of economics. Do you want to just give us an understanding of your idea around the helicopter money and how it can solve
it's
a lot of
pretty much based out of London, that same kind of thinking, right?
No.
The London financial systems.
Mm-mm.
Oh, okay.
No.
I out of my depth?
Well, that it comes down to identifying what's the problem, and the problem is too much private debt. That's what's caused the financial, caused the bubble in the first place. It's what's caused the aftermath of the zombie economies. So you've got to reduce private debt. Now, how can you do that? Well, private debt's created by banks just doing double entry bookkeeping. Here's a great, that house looks great. Here's $1 million to buy it. By the way, you owe us $1 million. That drives up asset prices. That's what got us into the situation. So banks created by double entry bookkeeping. They're not housekeeping. Not newer housing, they're creating it out of nothing. The government can do exactly the same thing. And that's how QE was financed. So in the case of UK, for example, they created $200 billion worth of QE per year, and there was not 1 cent raised in a QE tax, because you didn't need to raise the taxes to do the spending. So the government has the same capability. They create money, as they've done by QE, just by double entry bookkeeping. Here's $200 billion in your account. We'll take those bonds. We value it $200 billion, drive up our assets and drive up our liabilities at the same time. So you could use exactly the same capability and say the government is going to give money to the public on a per capita basis, and anybody who's in debt has to pay their debt down.
Yeah.
But anybody who's not in debt, there's a cash injection. And what I've elaborated that in my thinking by talking to some people in the equity world as well. What you could also do to limit the extent to which you overstimulated the economy by giving a cash injection to people who are savers would be to say, well, you've got to use X percent of that money to buy shares, and those shares can be used by the corporate sector to cancel their private debt as well. So we could reset the score system effectively. That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And government can do this because they own a bank.
Yeah, they've got their own. They're the only company, only institution in society which owns its own bank. And then we talk about them as if they don't own their own bank.
Yeah.
Well, let's just be realistic. Say they do. You might not like it, but they bloody well do. What can they do with their capability? Here's a few possibilities. And one of them is to reduce the level of credit-based money and increase the amount of fiat-based money effectively, because we've let far too much credit money be created in the last 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to clarify that, because we've had some issues around this exact issue in South Africa around the role of the South African Reserve Bank, and everyone's arguing that it's to, in fact, you know, it's monetary policy and it's to use interest rates as opposed to solve the employment problem. And the problem is it's come from the quarter that is really about the corruption and the looting in South Africa that's going on at the moment. How do we manage this? Because we don't want to become another Zimbabwe, which is effectively they've taken their bank and they've just run riot and they've devalued absolutely everything.
I mean, they've also destroyed, you know, productive resources there by trying to take the farm up, land off the farmers, and it's horrific behavior overall. So you do have that danger of central banks or governments getting out of control when they directly affect the central bank. I'm not a great fan of central bank independence in general, but I think because it's been a case of handing over to people who call themselves experts but really aren't experts.
No.
But I'd like to see some. Ultimately, expertise, you know, the sort of approach to capitalism and economics that I have takes over.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Then say, okay, we want to set the targets. We might let the politicians have some role in those targets, but generally speaking, the targets have to be for positive levels of government spending to exceed taxation.
Yes.
You know, But yeah, the when you got politicians, particularly like the big men politics of Africa, then I can see how that leads to disaster.
No, absolutely. Just a question, and it might be a naive question. Do we need to be paying tax if government's got this ability? Because, I mean, that's another way to put the money back into the pocket.
Yeah, this is a problem because if we were talking back in the days of the pre-1900s, government, the answer would be no, they wouldn't need to, because government is only the order of 5 or 10% of GDP at most, and the change in government spending was smaller again. So you could actually finance most of it by direct money printing.
Okay.
Now in governments of the order of 25 to 30%, if it financed its entire activities by seniorage, you'd be increasing the money supply by 15 to 20% per annum, which would just be overwhelming. You'd have inflation, you'd have all the problems we're talking about. So taxation is there to reduce the amount of money that's being created to allow new money to be spent. But it would be possible, and I'm actually considering writing a little book on this, what is the monetary system of Mars? At some point, and there may be in the next decade, Elon Musk hopes to have the beginning of a colony up on Mars, which will obviously be centrally planned and command economy when it starts. And everybody will be engineers and everybody's been dedicated and it'll work because, you know, you're building a whole new culture, a whole new outpost for humanity on another planet. But at some point, if it's actually viable, it's going to need its own economy. Now, in that situation, you could create a form of money which degraded over time. So the government could create money which then decayed unless you spent it. And in that situation, the decay process could reduce the need to have taxation. But in our case, we're stuck with money that doesn't decay, and therefore you do have this issue that the government has to tax to recirculate the money, and it does that in a very ineffective way and causes all sorts of social conflict.
That's absolutely brilliant, because it's actually quite interesting. We've got a project here in South Africa called Project Ubu, and they're trying to create a UBI framework on the blockchain. But a critical part of that UBI is the degradation of money. So it automatically so there's always a fixed amount. It's never going to spiral out of control. So it's quite an interesting project, and it'll be very interesting to see where they actually get with it.
I mean, what are the effects of having privatized tax on the blockchain? I mean, what would that be?
I'm not sure.
I mean, like, we're pushing the boundaries where you kind of are pushing the gathering of tax into that transparent kind of platform. I guess it's the circulation of money still.
It is, but I think you're trying to...
Yeah, I mean, you don't need tax to finance blockchain, just like you don't need tax to finance government spending. Mm. You might need it to reduce the impact that it's had, but I think the decay process has exactly the same impact.
I think Brett's trying to solve our corruption problem. Yes.
Getting the transparency around tax.
Absolutely. Absolutely brilliant. In terms of... Brett threw my question there. In terms of what government should be spending money on, do you have any framework? Because, I mean, in South Africa, we've got a very historical structure around our state-owned enterprises here. We've got airways, we've got railways, we've got harbors. So very much the old industries that government needed to set up because no individual had the capacity to set them up. Mm. I'm not too sure that they're working very well because they've become a route to corruption. Do you have any preference on where government or how government should be spending the money that they're creating?
There's two elements to that. One is that there's infrastructural things you don't want to be driven by profits. So, for example, you don't really care about the price of electricity as much as the fact that it actually arrives every second of every day. And so reliability matters far more than the return on the enterprise itself. That's the sort of thing where you want a government in control of rather than a private sector. And America learned that lesson through Enron. Though, of course, America never learns its lessons properly, does it? That's one element. So that's one part of your choices. The other is you want the government to be able to waste money on things which the private sector can't afford to waste money on. That's where the space race came from in the very first instance. There's no way there could have been a private venture to get to the moon back in the 1960s. That's why we have private ventures to get to Mars in 2020s. So the government, in that sense, innovation comes out of people who can afford to lose money. And there are two groups who can afford to lose money in capitalism. One is the government. The other is extremely wealthy individuals and venture capitalists. So have the government doing the blue sky stuff, pay for the nuclear research, try to bring out, start developing fusion reactors, liquid molten thorium reactors, that sort of thing.
Okay.
And then once it's profitable, then the private sector can take over. But in terms of infrastructural stuff where you want everybody to have access to something, then that's where I want the government involved. And telecommunications is still of that nature. I'll give you a little analogy, a little story of mine, which I find quite funny. I had a member of the Communist Party of South Korea come out to work with me 20 years ago in Australia. A very, very, very classic old Stalinist personality. But when he arrived, the apartment I got for him, he grabbed his laptop and started walking around the walls with a Ethernet cable trying to plug it in. I had to tell him, look, there is no Ethernet output. He said, what? Don't have Ethernet in every house?
Yeah.
And no, I had it in South Korea, which is a highly capitalist nation, basically told its telecommunications companies, we don't care how you do it, you've got to make sure everybody's got an Ethernet cable in every house in the country. And that was just a condition of being a telecommunications company in South Korea, that you had to do that. Well, where do you think Samsung came from?
Yeah.
It wasn't created by that, but the fact that that's a huge, what has become such a telecommunications powerhouse, is the government could afford to waste money in making sure that every kid in every bedroom in South Korea had a T100 Ethernet connection, whereas down in Australia they're still using bloody dial-up modems. Now, that's a case where that effectively, inverted commas, waste by the government generates private innovation at a later stage.
Yeah.
And that's one of the two elements I'd like to see. The other, of course, being health. You don't want your access to health and education being determined by how wealthy you are.
Yeah,
and,
I agree.
And that applies even to the wealthy. I mean, my favorite analogy there is Kerry Packer, who was Australia's wealthiest man. He died on a polo field, and he was lucky that the ambulance that came past had a defibrillator, and they brought him back to life again. And he then paid for a defibrillator in every ambulance in the country because he had no idea where he was going to be playing polo next. That is a case where, you know, it isn't just a case of wealth. You want some things you want to have available everywhere. That includes sanitation and so on. Those are the sort of things you want the government to pay for, not the private sector.
Yeah, and I think it requires a fundamental shift in how governments actually think about their role. I think it's as hard as the mainstream economists redefining their thinking. Just a question. On the mainstream, Steve, why are they so ignorant about this? Why are they? Because I mean, just the idea of rational man. I mean, and I think
it's not like a religion, right?
Yeah, it's like a religion.
Sacrificial cow.
But I remember my lectures at university, and I remember being increasingly frustrated. My first lecture was about supply and demand and the balance, and I was just like, folks, this can't work. The elastic's got to snap at some point. And they're like, no, it bounces back. You don't get it. You know the idea of this perfect economy and this perfect world and perfect employment and perfect whatever else, and the rational man. And I certainly know, looking at my children, there's nothing rational about them, and my wife thinks the complete opposite of me.
Let's not go there. You've got to go home.
He's
brave on radio, right?
He's brave, yeah. but the idea of rational man, why are economists so stuck in this false sense of academic ignorance?
It's a very good question, and I believe there's crap when I was a high school student, because when I did high school at the University of Australia in the 1960s, my textbook was more advanced than the textbooks we now use for second and third year at university here. And I swallowed all this stuff, and a large part of it, we are a belief-driven species.
Yeah.
I don't know that lions and wildebeest share belief systems.
No.
We certainly do.
No.
And that belief system, the fact to share the beliefs, means we actually act on those beliefs, and that's partly where we became the dominant species on the planet. That's what trips us up, because we have this belief that we can actually design a perfect society. And the neoclassical vision of a perfect world, equilibrium, yada, 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 is a perfect world, and they become zealots committed to that vision. And that vision traps them when they're teenagers. You know, young boys with too much testosterone and not enough outlet for it, and that's that classically defines economists, end up believing in this stuff and trying to proselytize the world to believe and think the way they do. And therefore, the belief system dominates rather than any sensible, genuinely rational feedback about what actually happens when you try these ideas in practice.
Yeah, this herd mentality, the tribe mentality. Steve, in terms of the coming crisis, what is your timeline on this? And I know it's a very, very difficult thing to predict.
We need to throw this forward a little bit, right?
In the next 1 to 3 years, the characteristics that I need to see to say I think the economy is going to have a crisis are twofold. First of all, the level of private debt. Mm. It has to be substantial compared to GDP. Something above 1.5 times GDP. And secondly, it has to be growing fairly rapidly. So a growth rate where credit's growing every year by of the order of 10% of GDP or more. Now, the countries that qualified on that front include at the very top, of course, China. And China's gone from a debt level at 2009 of about 110% of GDP to 210% a mere, 8 years later. That's a huge increase in credit, and that's made them when the rate of growth of credit slows down, they'll have a slump caused by that alone. The next largest country is South Korea, and South Korea on that front, South Korea, as you're looking at for here, I'm looking at my list as I talk, China's Korea, has gone from 160% of GDP at the time of the financial crisis to 190% now. Worse still, the countries like Australia and Canada. Australia's gone from, in 2012, 180% to 210% now. Canada, which I think is probably the most likely one to have a crunch very soon, Canada's gone from, at the time of the financial crisis, 170% of GDP to 220%. That's a massive increase. They're dependent upon that maintained credit growth continuing indefinitely. It won't continue indefinitely, and when it does, they'll have a slump. But that really implies the next 1 to 3 years.
Okay. And in terms of how to manage yourself around this, any suggestions?
Well, the only suggestion that makes sense is the one that causes the problem in the first place. This is where stability is destabilizing, of course.
Yeah.
Getting out of debt. If you can liquidate your assets and have no debt, you're in a very comfortable situation in a downturn. But because you liquidate your assets and have no debt, you're cancelling the money that you use to pay that debt down, and therefore you reduce the amount of demand money in the economy and reduce demand. So your personal decision has an impact on the aggregate nature of the economy.
Okay.
I mean, all those countries you listed have very low interest rates, right? So
they've been forced into it.
Yeah, they've been forced into it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Fascinating. So all of a sudden it's really cheap to get debt.
Yeah,
which of course encourages you to continue moving into the point where you can afford to take on no more debt, because the rates will never fall below 2%. In terms of the rate you and I face. So what you do is if you continue driving it down, you start getting to the point where the servicing costs on that debt become astronomical, not because the rates are very high, but because the amount of debt you owe is very high. And then you're stuck in a corner. Once the debt can't continue growing, then you have a crisis.
Yeah. Sure. And Steve, your thought process around blockchain and its impact and in comparison to fiat currency, because that's really what's driving this is fiat currency.
Some of the foundation ideas behind things like Bitcoin in particular were based on myths. So the fact that 21 million Bitcoin was based on the idea that there's a fixed amount of gold, therefore we'll have a fixed amount of Bitcoin. Yeah. Mm. But somebody else can invent a new form of digital money. You can't invent a new form of gold. So it's a false analogy.
That's a good point. And cryptocurrencies, right? There are thousands of them.
Yeah. There's a dozen now. And also, because you're using the no centralized exchange system, the time delays in validating a transaction to actually occur with a no-trust framework means it takes up to 10 minutes to validate a transaction. Mm. Now, but that's not valid, but it's actually putting it into the blockchain rather than validating, where it's milliseconds to do the validation. If we combined blockchain with centralized exchange, then you could have digital money with the speed and low cost of fiat-based money. And I see it playing a role, but at the moment it's too volatile. You need to have a more stable price of the actual financial asset itself to make it feasible to imagine it could take over as a form of money. Mm. And ultimately, money is simple. If you're going to have 30 and 40 and 50 different currencies, you've got to decide what to buy with. That gets too complicated for people, and that's why everybody only buys a Big Mac when they go to McDonald's. The optimum's just too overwhelming. You'll take the same thing you had last time round. And that's partly why I don't think we're going to get a world of multiple competing currencies. You'll come down to one currency ultimately, but the blockchain technology could play a major role in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Steve, really a kind of a wrap-up question from my side. What happens when we actually hit the zombie state?
I am just picturing zombies everywhere, personally.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very real scenario, though. I mean, what do you see happening? Because, I mean, it's a hard picture to kind of conceptualize.
Well, I see the political instability we've seen becoming even more common. So the fact that Donald Trump got elected is completely a factor here. Equally, the fact that Jeremy Corbyn is on a hiding to nothing to win the next election in the UK. That Le Pen almost won in France. all this sort of stuff is a public reaction to the fact that what was the ultimate pact that made capitalism successful? Everybody benefits, you know, some more than others, but you're all going to benefit. When the working class, which is the majority, starts to get screwed, then you get more and more political instability. So in the aftermath of this, particularly with things like QE making the wealthy even wealthier, there'll be more political instability, more so-called populism, not because it's unthinking, but because the mainstream itself was unthinking. So I see a lot of political instability and really a social breakdown coming out of that. The only way out, I think, is going to be having to finally make a sensible response to the global, to the ecological crisis we're obviously approaching.
Yes.
And in that situation, we might finally do like we did during the Second World War, which is fight an existential crisis with everything at our disposal, and thereby doing it, eliminate the problem that caused the existential crisis in the first place.
Get rid of the debt.
Yeah, and hope like hell we've learned the lesson properly this time.
Pardon, sorry?
And hope like hell we've learned the lesson properly this time when we go through it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know about that.
Professor Steve Keen, thank you. This has been
an absolute
privilege to spend the hour chatting to you. I appreciate your time and thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you. A great conversation. And pop me the link and I'll back it up on my Twitter followers as well.
Fantastic. I'll share the notes and I'll also share out your Patreon account and your links to the books, etc. on our site here.
And very quickly for our audience, please remember it's at Futurology Show. If you go to iTunes or any of the podcasting apps, please give us 5 stars. And I think we've had an absolutely fantastic show. I must admit, this is the brightest I've ever heard Mike sound like.
I did my homework.
He gets home, though. He's got a problem with his wife already.
Yes. Yeah, I do. I do. Yeah, it's a normal case, though, Steve. Fantastic. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, bye.
Cheers. Thank you.
This is CliffCentral.com.